by default. Though if there's still some coming in, if we're late because of the convocation, I think that is a good reason. I'll just make a comment. I can't restrain myself, but it is so exciting, I think, and refreshing to find someone who is truly competent as a thoughtful scholar and theologian. What was his name? Miller? Roland Miller was. And he talked to us as a faculty at our faculty forum yesterday, too, and got into, you know, a little bit more intellectual and highbrow issues. He certainly is beyond peer, I would think, in terms of his understanding of theology, issues in world religions, and using that now as a way of understanding the Muslim mission and the task that is before us. But to combine all that, which is much more cerebral and intellectual and academic, with some obvious fire in his belly, is a pretty good combination. And we got lots of people with fire in their belly, but nothing in their heads. And we got lots of people with something in their heads and no fire in their belly. And I would hope that you might combine those two. I think that's really where the church is at. And to realize, too, that evangelism is something far deeper and more significant than saying superficial stuff. That for Christianity, as well as it is for other religions, it's that old saying, I guess, what the surface water does is driven by something from far below, much deeper than that. And to sort of mess around on the surface can produce surface results. But sooner or later, there's some deep issues here that really need to be not only addressed, but first understood. And even the point that much of Muslim misunderstanding of Christianity goes back to those ancient heresies of the early church is a reminder that maybe, just maybe, sorting out how we explain the communication of attributes and actually plowing through some of the niceties of Piper Volume 2 has something to do with the mission of the church. While you may not engage in those kinds of arguments at every stage along the way, sooner or later, those are some of the compelling issues that come from below and are driving what goes on the surface. I shared this with some of you heard this yesterday in Hebrew class, but almost by divine providence, perhaps, or serendipity, several of us at this meeting we went to over the weekend in Tulsa ended up in a taxi cab with a Muslim driver who immediately engaged us in theological discussion. And the three things that came out of his misunderstanding of Christianity: he grew up in a Southern Baptist family, and so we asked him why in the world he sort of rejected Christianity, and the first thing he said was that God married a woman, and he just couldn't understand this Son of God stuff. So no understanding of Trinitarian Christological issues at all, exactly what Dr. Miller said today. The second thing he didn't like about Christianity was that you can't understand the Bible because it's written in King James English. And I think that's a reminder, and here coming out of what was probably a fundamentalist family, to sort of stake your theological life on the King James translation is just silly. When we tried to explain to him that it's not written in King James English, in fact, it's not even written in English, but like them, we respect the language of Revelation, and he was said that he has learned some Arabic so that he could read the Quran in Arabic, that we too are serious about the actual languages in which God's Word is written. And of course, the third point that came out in the discussion, Harold, you were in a cab too. I think I'm capturing the essence of this, is that when all is said and done, he reflected exactly what Dr. Miller outlined today as their essential law works righteous religion, that Jesus too was a prophet, but who came essentially to give us the guidance for our living. And our eternal salvation is essentially based on whether or not we have more notches in the good column than in the bad column. And that, of course, is where, you know, all law religions eventually come out. And that was sadly, painfully clear in our discussion with him. And it's just a case in point that we can't ignore this as though it's something for esoteric missionaries to worry about in India or the Middle East. Even if that were the case, that doesn't mean we ignore it. Certainly this is a factor in our own society as well. Well, enough of an aside. The task at hand is Exodus 15 and Easter. Oh, blessed Easter. Sadly, I'd be willing to bet that even if one appreciates Exodus 15 and perhaps has actually worked through it in the original text and come to some tremendous theological conclusions, you probably won't preach on Exodus 15 on Easter. Except for Greg here, who's going to do it. Good for you. I'm sure that's more the exception than the rule. And it's interesting that when you get to the big, big festivals of the church year, like Christmas and Easter, people almost expect to hear the same old story. And that's okay. I'm not saying that's bad at all. In fact, that probably is what you should do. Though it becomes, after you've preached in perhaps the same parish for quite a few years, sort of increasingly difficult to come up with sort of a new spin on the same old story. For that reason, if for none other, perhaps it's time to go to a different text and get a little bit different angle on it. But I think you have to respect, too, that you don't want to kind of blindside the people and they're going, gee, I thought this was Easter, and he's talking about the Exodus. Now, that the Exodus has something to do with Easter is fair enough, and you certainly can make those connections, but don't ignore the fact that your people are expecting an Easter sermon. But to find the same motifs in Exodus is the task at hand, and to realize how appropriate this is, if for no other reason than they're singing a song of victory for the redemption that God has now completed. That redemption, sort of implied death as well as life, is clear. Not only from the death of the firstborn son, which isn't a bad motif to pull out of the Exodus, but here also the death of Pharaoh's army, that sin and all that is representative of sin is destroyed, and that life is really the other side of the same coin on which death is also printed. So here we have the celebration of a great victory. It's a war victory. There was a great battle that took place. What's remarkable about Good Friday and Easter is that the loser turns out to be the winner. I mean, if all we had were Good Friday, it would certainly seem that the good team had lost that battle. But Easter, in the motif of God's great reversal, just turns everything upside down, and you find out that, in fact, it wasn't a defeat at all, but it was a victory won by defeat. Well, let's translate this. Now, philologically, this is rough stuff. Exodus 15 is some of the oldest Hebrew in the Bible. Most scholars would agree that this is the oldest poem, which is therefore probably the oldest piece, just in terms of the linguistic data. So we've got some tough vocabulary and stuff like that. But it's not that impossible. Let's see what we can do. First, we have the narrative introduction, verse 15. Az Yashir Moshe uvnei Yisrael eth hashira hazoth. Well, you can translate that if you know the word shir. Shir is the noun for song and the verb for sing. Could have figured that out. It's a hollow root. Az means then. It's an adverb, temporal adverb. Then, Yashir Moshe. Here's the imperfect verb form of the hollow root shir. Moses sang. Oh, not just Moses, by the way, B'nai Yisrael. Notice the verb is still singular. This is just typical Hebrew, where the subject is singular, but then they always add something. Uv'nai Yisrael, and the sons of Israel, sang Eth Hashira Hazoth, the song, the this one. Okay? Le Yahweh, to Yahweh, v'yomaru, now the verb goes plural, assuming we've got all the subjects added up now, and they said, le'mor, actually they probably sang it, but singing and saying tend to overlap. Now, it always bothered me in the liturgy when you get to the end of the proper preface, how does that go, and angels and archangels and all join and said, and then we sing this song. I guess it works either way. Ashira, sheer, again, we've just learned that verb. Literally, this is a cohortative. Let me sing. Kal cohortative, la Yahweh, ki gao ga'a. Oh, golly, an infinitive absolute. Yes, try to restrain yourselves. Gao ga'a. Kal, infinitive absolute of a third hey root. Ga'a means to be high. Lots of words for sort of elevated in the sense of kind of majestic or glorious. For he is indeed, truly, certainly exalted. However you're going to translate ga'a, for he is very high. Sus v'rochavo rama bayam. Horse and its rokev, its riding guy. It's really the participle of rakav. Horse and its rider. Rama is a third hey verb from Rama. He has thrown bayam in the yam. You can translate that. Ozi v'zimrath ya. Didn't we just do this line? Do you remember we did this line in Isaiah 12, which was the Old Testament lesson from 2 weeks, not this past Sunday, but the previous Sunday, where this line is quoted in Isaiah 12. And we talked a little bit about the history of this word Zimrath that is now translated song, but probably originally had to do with something about power and strength, which is the good parallel with Ozi. Ozi means strength. My strength and a song, or something like that, probably my strength and strength, is Yah. Vahili, and he has been to me for Yeshua, Lishua. The Lamed elides with the Shua of Yeshua. This idiom of Hayah and Lamed, remember, is the idiom for not to be, but to become. Hayah La, to be to something means to become something. So you can translate this, he has become for me salvation. Well, you could even move to he has become my salvation, but it's I think it's broader than that. He has become salvation for me, too. Ze Eli. This is Eli. Now, this is the noun, El, plus the pronominal suffix, E. Goes on singular nouns. This isn't the preposition El, which takes pronominal suffixes that go on plural forms, but this is the pronominal suffixes that go on singular forms. You remember that distinction? And that's what tells you that this is, in fact, a singular noun. Eli, therefore, means my God. This is my God, and on wehu. Ooh, boy, there's a funny-looking verb form. This is actually hifil of a third hey root nawa that means, nobody knows, it's a hapax legomenon. Nawa must mean something like praise from the context. And note you have a pronominal, an object suffix on the end. I will praise him. Elohe avi, the God of my father, and I will Ramam is the so-called poleil of the hollow root room. Remember that hollow roots don't occur in the D system, PL and Pual and Hithpael, because there's no middle root letter to double. So they double the last root letter, and you end up with these so-called poleil forms that look like they've got three root letters, but they really have two, but the second one's doubled, artificially so. So this is room. In sort of a transitive poleil or PL sense. I will elevate him. Ru means to be high, poleil, exalt. Again with object suffix, I in an energic nun. Oh man, you got everything in this form. I will pray, exalt him. Yahweh ish milchama, Yahweh shemo. Well, there's your sermon text. You can do something with that, though this is very politically incorrect. I remember in a session at one of these professional meetings where they were literally debating what to do with passages like this, because it's just inappropriate to talk about God as a man of war. that this sort of militant, military metaphor in the Bible is unacceptable. Yahweh is, unfortunately, that's about the only way you can translate the words that are there. Yahweh is a man of war. Yahweh Shemo, his name. The Markeveth, here in plural, Markavoth, here you see the root rakav, to ride. This is the noun for not rider or riding thing, but stuff, chariotry, all right, the cavalry. Chariotry of Pharaoh and his chael, his force, his power, his strength. I mean, we talk about the armed forces. That's really what chael means, force, power, but it can be used sort of for the whole military. He has, again, you have a sort of a synonym to the Ramah we had, except this is Yara. He is thrown down by Yam in the sea. And the Mivkar of Shiloshal, Mivkar is a noun from Bakar to choose. Is the select guy of his third guy. Now, I don't want to get lost cavalry things, but this has to do with the third man in the chariot, presumably. The third guy was sort of your shooter guy. You had one guy to ride the chariot. I guess one guy sort of did, rode shotgun. And then this guy actually shot arrows, and he was sort of the marksman. So it's sort of talking about the best. All right, these are your special force kind of guys. I don't know what would be the appropriate analogy. The chosen of his third guys, they have been tubu. Look at this, a pool. They have been sunk. What's the passive of sink? Sunk. Sunk can be transitive or intransitive, right? Or are you sank? Put in the tank. They have been sunk by Yam Suf, in Yam Suf, Sea of Suf, Suf Sea, or Reed Sea. Remember, in Hebrew, this is Reed Sea. Suf means sea, weed. Five, Tehomoth, you get this in Genesis 1, for the deeps, all right? The deeps, now this is imperfect, but I'm going to take it as past. If you don't like that idea, go read the literature. This is pretty standard stuff in ancient poetry, that preforms and aforms alternate back and forth. Ugaritic does this all the time. The deeps have kasad, covered over them. Note the u-mo ending here. That's the sort of an ancient alternate third plural object suffix. Yaradu, they have gone down in the mitzaloth, these are the depths, like an evan. We just had evan in beginning Hebrew. This is the word for stone. So they have gone down in the deeps like a stone. Six, Yaminaka Yahweh, your right hand, Yamin, right arm, your right arm, O Yahweh, take this as vocative, is Nedari. Nobody knows what the E ending is here. It's maybe an ancient case ending or something, or I don't. Nobody knows. Adar means to be splendor. This seems to be a Nifal participle, to be glorious or something. Your right arm, O Yahweh, glorious Bakoach in the strength. Yiminka, Yahweh, your right hand, O Yahweh, will ra'atz the enemy. Ra'atz is a verb for destroy. Strong word, shatter, demolish, annihilate the enemy. Seven, in the rove, in the muchness of your ga'on, again is from a verb, the concept of height, here probably strength. In the muchness, the multitude, rav is really a rove here, is usually strength of number, which is interesting. Are these the heavenly hosts? In the multitude of your strength, taros, you harass, whatever harass means, another word for demolish. Kameka, your rising up guys. Kam is the participle of kum, to stand, to rise up. your rising guys. Well, here this is the idiom for those who rise up against you. That would be the idea, those who stand up against you. Tishalach, note the PL here. You have shalacht, sent forth your charon, your anger. Charon is anger. You have sent forth with intensity your anger. Yochalemo, it consumes them. Akal really means to eat here, but in the sense of get rid of. It consumes them. Kash. Kash is the word for stubble, what you have after you cut the grain, okay? And is often burned. It consumes them like stubble. 8. Uv ruach, in and in the ruach of your af. Now, af really means nose. Ruach really means wind. So is this talking about some sort of divine sneeze? In the wind of your nose. This is, both of these become idiomatic for anger. In the breath of your anger, or the force of your anger. And seeing we just had the noun charon, which is anger, that's certainly the image here. But don't forget about wind as something other than just a metaphor here. I mean, the whole business of crossing the sea was done by this wind piling up the waters, and that's what's going on here. Okay, so you really literally have wind going on. By the wind of your nose or your anger, the water netraku. Oh boy, parse it. Nifal, you can do this. Nifal, perfect, third plural, of a root aram, which nobody knows for sure what it means, like most of the words here. Pile up, apparently, be in a heap. The waters were piled up. Nitzavu, from natsav, to be positioned. Again, nifal. They were positioned, kamo, like a nath. A nath is some rise. Whether this means a hill or a mountain or a wall isn't completely clear. But they are positioned like a nath. And now we get a goofy participle that really means to flow. Nazal means to flow, obviously describing the water. So the flowing stuff is the subject of the second colon here. The flowing things were positioned like a wall. Does that mean they stopped flowing? You know, who knows? 8b, ka-fu. Again, no one knows what kafa means. Generally translated congeal, to come together like jello. And the subject is the Tihomoth. The deeps have concealed belev yam, in the heart of yam. 9. Amar oyev, an enemy said, erdof, I will radaf. Have we had radaf? Pursue. Asig, I will nasag, overtake. Echalek shalal, to chalak shalal. Shalal is the word for spoil or booty. Chalak means to divvy it up. I will divide up the booty. Timla emo napshi. The subject here is napshi. Myself, I myself, my nefesh, will be filled of it. The object, or of them, sorry, probably the spoils. The amo is the object suffix. So my nefesh will be satisfied or filled up with them, i.e. the booty. This is what the other team's saying. Arik, I will bear my cherev, my sword. My hand will dispossess them. Ra, yarash, hifil, to gain possession of. 10. I'm hustling here, Jim. I'm trying to. We got started late and then I rambled. So what else is new? Verse 10. Nashaf, you blew. This means to blow like wind. You blew beruchaka by your ruach. Kisamo yam. Sea covered it. Or them, i.e. the opposing forces. Tzalalu, They sank like Ophiret. Ophiret is a noun for lead. Before they sank like a rock. They sank like lead, b'mayim, in waters, strong ones. Adir means mighty. Finally, verse 11, which is the second refrain. There are three refrains in this poem. We had the first one in verse 6. Your hand, your right hand, O Yahweh, is majestic in power. Your right hand, O Yahweh, destroy the enemy. Now we get to sort of the middle refrain. Mi kamoka, who is like you? Ba elim, in the elim, one of the rare uses of the plural of ale. Amongst the elim, O Yahweh, who kamoka is like you. By the way, notice the old hays there. Here's when the second person suffix was written with the mater letter, hey. You just learned this is kamoka, without the hay on the end. Who is like you? Nedar, we already had, majestic or tremendous. Bit kodesh, in the holy place. Now, there's an interesting footnote here, and I'd like to offer an alternate reading based on the Septuagint. Among the hagios, which simply reads this as plural, okay? Now, this is very attractive because the parallel is elim. This isn't place, it's the deities, the holy ones, all right? That's quite attractive just from, however, Kodesh then becomes the harder reading because, you know, yeah, why would I want to do that? I thought it'd be nice to try out the Septuagint. Who is like you among the gods, O Yahweh? Who is like you in splendor among the holy ones, if you will, or the other cultic deities? Tehiloth. Nora is the niphal participle of yara, to fear, something feared, terrible, awesome, feared. No, none of those words mean anything today anymore. You know, awesome has pretty much been stripped of its meaning. Terrible in praise. Isn't that an interesting juxtaposition of a sort of oxymoronic words? Terrible of... Tehiloth is praise is, it's the plural, you see halal in the middle of that. So terrible of praises, doing pella. Pella is the word for supernatural stuff, mighty wonders, stuff that can't be explained by ordinary means. That's not a bad way to end, but that's where the pericope ends. Golly, we got to hustle, Jim, I'm sorry, we better, what are you doing? Is this one of those Easter gospels that you're compelled to preach on? Lieu of the Old Testament lesson? Just the resurrection? Yeah, well, okay, we can knock that off in about 8 minutes.